from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Merry Christmas! Coming up next on this special Christmas Day edition of Forum, two interviews from Forum's archives. First, where did Christmas customs like tree decorating, stocking stuffing, and gift-giving originate? Was St. Nick a real person? Well, Bruce David Forbes joins Forum to discuss his book, Christmas, A Candid History. Then at 9:30, National Book Award winner Sherman Alexie joins us on Forum to talk about his new story collection, Blasphemy. That's all coming up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Merry Christmas. Now, that festive greeting could be taken as a religious or a cultural greeting, and we thought we would help you, our listeners, better understand the day that is being celebrated today throughout the world, and especially the Western world. Bruce David Forbes will be joining us in this special Christmas Day pre-record of Forum. He's the author of a book called Christmas, A Candid History, and we learned from the book, well, a lot of illuminating tidbits, such as early Christians in the first two or three centuries did not celebrate Christmas, and Puritans in England and in New England made Christmas observances illegal, and St. Nicholas is an elf in the famous poem The Night Before Christmas. And the United States Congress regularly met on Christmas Day into the 1850s. Well, all of those kinds of facts are what we're going to be looking at today, as well as the origins of Christmas. Just to add a couple more here, President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, changed the date of Thanksgiving in order to lengthen the Christmas shopping season. And speaking about shopping, guess who helped fashion Santa Claus's look in an advertising campaign? Coca-Cola. Well, we learn all that again from Bruce Forbes, who is professor of religious studies at Morningside College and co-edits University of California Press's Religion and Popular Culture in America. He joins us for the hour, and we welcome you. Merry
it's
Christmas.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
This is going to be broadcast on Christmas, so I'll say Merry Christmas to you. And
very good.
Or Happy Holidays, or whatever is acceptable these days to whomever. Actually, let's begin, if we may, by talking again about the roots of Christmas, because I'm looking at an email here. We invited our listeners to call in and tell us Christmas stories and ask questions and email us. One of them said, you know, don't be afraid to tackle the pagan roots. Well, they are pagan roots, pretty to some degree at least, are they not?
Indeed. First, I think you have to say a word about pagan, that word. For some people, it causes all kinds of different reactions, some of affection and some of fear. Pagan, in a sense, simply means non-Christian or pre-Christian. And it's certainly true that all kinds of things that we associate with Christmas are really rooted in winter festivals that predate Jesus ever being born on this earth. It's one of the things that interested me most, I'd even say surprised me most as I worked on the book, is to understand the importance of winter festivals. I mean, I've heard people over and over say, oh, there are pagan roots to Christmas. In a way, I mean, it's true that there are some rival or other religions involved here, but in a way, it's about what human beings understandably need to do to survive in winter. I'm speaking to you from Minnesota. We know what winter is like up here. And if you think about what people have to struggle with, the cold, the dark, in some ways it's almost like walking into death and hoping you come out on the other side. What would human beings do? I mean, you could almost guess before you study early cultures. What would human beings do to try to survive winter? I have an idea. Let's have a great big blowout midwinter party.
And many of these were midwinter festivals, of course, right?
Yes.
Right in the midst of that cold and blankets of snow and whatever.
And those festivals became more and more important in Christianity when Christianity moved into Central and Northern Europe, where the winters were more severe.
Well, I want to talk about that move with you, too, but we don't really have an actual birth date for the date of Jesus Christ. In fact, if anything, a lot of the pagan roots suggest that maybe there were darker forces around wintertime because you were glad to get through winter and find the spring when things would be resurrected, as is maybe traditionally celebrated in Easter with a resurrection and all that fertility, Easter eggs and bunnies and whatnot. So I'm just struck by the fact that this date of December 25th was taken. Tell us a little bit about that, how that came to be.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I do wish we had some definitive document where a pope or a a Roman emperor said, and this year we're going to start this birthday celebration about Jesus, and this is why we did it. We don't have that, so we have to guess. But what we do know is that in the Roman Empire, in the time of early Christianity, there were three sometimes pretty wild midwinter festivals. The first one was Saturnalia, which ran for several days in the middle of December.
In ancient Rome, right?
In ancient Rome.
Yeah.
And having to do with Saturn, and it's kind of a harvest festival, which really developed a reputation for all kinds of wanton behavior. Second big celebration is Calends, which is kind of a New Year's festival. We get our word calendar from that, first day of the month. But their New Year's festival was not just one night and one day. It went for about 5 days. And then in between those two, you did have already a religious celebration happening on December 25th, because it was the birthday of the sun god, Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun, also associated with Mithras. Different books confusingly talk about these different gods, but eventually they fused. That's why we're talking about both of them. And of course, you would have a birth of the sun god at the time when the days stop getting shorter and are ready to lengthen again. And so all of those celebrations or parties or whatever existed in Roman culture. Christians come along and belatedly decide to celebrate the birth of Jesus, and they decide to put that birthday right in the middle of those three parties and exactly on the date of the birthday of the sun god. In a way, it shifts it from the birthday of the sun god to God the Son, spelled differently.
And the Yule of Northern Europe, that fits in here too, at least in terms of the roots, doesn't it?
Exactly. Just as these are winter festivals, not such a severe winter in Italy, winter festivals also exist elsewhere in Europe. Yule, that we've come to use that term to mean Christmas, but in fact there were Yule celebrations in Northern Europe, lands that we would call Germany and now. And
this is YULE, not Tom Yule, the actor.
Yeah, exactly. And Scandinavia, all of those folks had Yule celebrations that predated Christianity.
What you write, in fact, is that Christmas is like a snowball, kind of rolled through Europe and then to America, and it picked up things as it went along, picked up some, well, traditions and dropped others, some festivals and practices and dropped others. That metaphor really works, huh?
I don't know. Does it work for you? I'm kind of proud of it because I think it's my creation. And I do think it works, because it is true that when we try to look back at the exact beginnings of certain traditions, they're a little fuzzy. But I think the process is quite clear. And that is that as Christianity, which belatedly started a celebration of Jesus's birthday, then starts to move through Europe, then to the Americas, then elsewhere, it keeps bumping up against winter celebrations that already exist in each one of those areas. And so, like a snowball — this isn't a snowball that you throw at someone, but that you roll to make a snowman or something — it picks up various elements of winter festivals in different countries and different regions, and then moves them on to the next area. It's an interesting process of morphing.
That's where the Yule came from, I guess, huh?
So that we talk about the Yule log, etc., and we think that that's a Christmas tradition. It's really a pre-Christmas tradition that then got wrapped up in the snowball.
And thus the Christmas tree, in part at least.
Yes. And, you know, we're talking about several things that repeat over and over in winter celebrations. One is that it makes sense that a winter celebration would be a festival with light. And so you'd have candles and burning logs and all the rest. That thus you get the Yule log, you get various candles and other kinds of Christmas celebrations once they become part of Christmas. The other thing that's predictable is evergreens or greenery of some kind, because in the winter, when it looks like everything dies, it would make sense to feature something that continued life. And evergreens and other kinds of greenery were used from the earliest days in winter celebrations. Eventually, it gets to be a tree. That's probably German. But greenery predated it. And then the tree, it's interesting how it moves from Germany to Victorian England, because the House of Hanover, Queen Victoria, those folks were of German background. And then once that popularity spreads in England, it also spreads to the United States. The snowball rolls along.
Where do the poinsettias come in?
Isn't that a great story? I The poinsettia is a native Mexican plant. And, of course, Christianity is brought to what we now call Mexico by Spaniards. And once the Christmas celebration starts there, they incorporate this plant because we tend to say that the flower is red leaves. Really, those are the leaves. The flower is the yellow center in that plant. But those leaves get to have those bright colors when the amount of sunlight diminishes. So it's a winter blooming plant. And so that makes sense that as Christians come in, they're celebrating Christmas, they incorporate this winter blooming plant into their celebration. This wonderful story that develops about a little girl who wants to bring a gift to the baby Jesus, has nothing beautiful enough to offer. In tears, she doesn't know what to do, but in courage, she takes a handful of weeds to the manger of the baby Jesus. Jesus turns them into brilliant, beautiful flowers. They become called flowers of the holy night. So it's part of Mexican Christmas celebrations. Then the first United States ambassador to Mexico happens to be an amateur botanist, is fascinated with this plant, brings it back to the United States. That ambassador's name happened to be Poinsett. And now, I mean, we have poinsettias everywhere in the United States.
That is, as you say, a great story. We're talking, by the way, with Bruce David Forbes, who tells a lot of the stories that are associated with Christmas, but the stories behind the stories of Christmas in his book, Christmas, A Candid History. He's a professor of religious history. And getting into the history here is kind of fascinating because we talked about the date, December 25th. The first evidence, as you point out in your book, of that date actually being celebrated as written evidence, that is in the 4th century. And the reason may strike some people as rather late in the game, but the reason is because early Christianity, as you point out, was so Easter-centered.
Indeed. Everything was about the death and resurrection of Jesus. And the early Christians, there are a number of passages in Christian scripture where they expected Jesus to come again within their lifetime. So they really didn't have a lot of time for institutionalizing many other things. The focus was death and resurrection. And even the early martyrs were remembered not for their birthdays, but for their death days. That was their birthday into eternal life. That was the focus of early Christianity. And this does surprise people, but even Christian scriptures give very little attention to the birth of Jesus. That may come as a surprise because we read certain passages over and over again. But of the four Christian gospels, two of them almost ignore the birth of Jesus. The Gospel of Mark starts out with John the Baptist baptizing Jesus. They're both adults, so there's no birth story in the Gospel according to Mark. And in John, there's flowery language about the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, but there's no story of a baby in a manger. So
we've got two stories in Matthew and Luke, but they're two different stories.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hate to admit that I was slow to recognize this, but I think I was well into young adulthood before it dawned on me that when I went to Christmas services, they were reading from only two Gospels, not all four. And then it was only later after that that I'd read the stories in the two Gospels that did say something, and they were almost totally different stories. So really, the scriptural material gives you just crumbs, and you have to take these two different stories, put them together. I mean, one story has shepherds, the other story has kings, or really not kings, wise men.
But none of them have a donkey. We want to
right, and no camels. All those animals that are so wonderful in the nativity scene, they're not mentioned in the scriptural account. We have to add things in to bring the story alive.
No bright star, as you point out. No specific number of wise men. No kings, and no names.
Yes. These are all traditions that we've added, and I understand why we've done that, because we're just enchanted by this story, but we have to flesh it out.
Yeah, when did those stories start coming along in terms of it being fleshed out in those ways?
Well, I think those are progressive all along the tradition. I mean, I think nowadays there's even, I keep running into stories about a crippled shepherd boy, which I think some of which is related to A Mall and the Night Visitors, a beautiful little operetta that really came from the 1950s. So all along the centuries, we've just continued with our creativity to add to the story.
Christmas itself, we should point out, as you do in your book, the word goes back to the 11th century from Christ Mass. It's not really until the 11th century.
Correct. And, of course, here we're talking English because you have other languages with other kinds of terms. But the term that we use in the English-speaking world is Christ, is Christmas, which comes from Christ's Mass, which would really refer to probably the midnight Mass given about Jesus' birth on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, actually, I'm in the process of writing a new book now, and one of the things that was that struck me was Jesus' real name, which would have been Yeshua ben Yosef, Yeshua son of Joseph. Today would be Josh Josephson, I guess, if we wanted to be really contemporary about
it. Or something like that,
yes. Something like that. We're talking to Bruce David Forbes, by the way, professor of religious studies over at Morningside College and co-editor of Religion and Popular Culture in America on this Christmas Day. Merry Christmas. He's written a book called Christmas, A Candid History, a paperback with one of those lovely scenes of families in front of the Christmas tree and all that holiday cheer and holiday spirit. As you point out, though, in your book, and we'll get back to the origins, but Christmas is really both a religious holiday and a cultural holiday, certainly in America.
I think that might, to think of it that way, may help us sort out some of the arguments we have, because in a way we do have two Christmases. One's a cultural Christmas, one is a Christian or a religious Christmas. They are so fused together for many of us that we don't really pull them apart, but some of the conflict starts because some people prefer the cultural holiday, aren't really into the religious one, and when people celebrate it different ways, sometimes they want other people to celebrate it their way.
Well, those who are interested in the religious arguments can see a whole array of positions. You do, in effect, what we like to think we do in this public radio broadcasting program that we put out every day. You have Paul Barnett, for example, Anglican bishop, Robert Miller, religious studies teacher, Raymond Brown is a Catholic priest, and they're all different in their way that they view Christmas religiously. I mean, it sort of covers the whole spectrum.
Yeah, what you're referring to especially is the question about, is this Christmas story really historical, or is it a symbolic story that says certain things about Jesus, but it really didn't happen that way?
And all different positions, yeah.
Yeah, if you look at various biblical scholars and so on, they argue about that. And you're right, just as public radio does. I'm a college professor, and what I do in classes, my students often laugh at me. They say, Bruce really likes lists, because I'm repeatedly saying, on this issue, I think there are four different positions, or three, or five. And we try to discuss them and then get various persons' reactions. In the book, I try to do that with these different positions about whether Christmas is historical or not.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Santa, because St. Nicholas and the whole tradition is another example of something that morphed. It was actually a bishop. He wasn't the jolly gift giver with the beard that had a lap for children that we now have in our lives. Huh?
Not at all. This is one of the most extraordinary cases of various traditions morphing over and over again throughout the centuries. We really don't know a lot about St. Nicholas. I think we're pretty sure that he was an historical person. And in Catholic tradition, he's a saint. However, in Vatican II, when the celebration of a number of saints' days became optional, St. Nicholas is one of the persons who became optional because so little can be verified about him historically. But we have just wonderful, wonderful legends about him. He apparently was a bishop in Myra, which is in what would now be Turkey, in the 300s. And I can tell you one of the most well-known legends, and that is that he was the only child of a wealthy family, and when he became bishop, one of his goals was to die having given away all his wealth. And the story is told that he was walking down the streets one day, overheard through the window of a home, a poor widowed father talking to his daughters and saying regretfully that he had no dowry to offer, so the daughters probably would not be able to marry. They might be sold into slavery or worse. So St. Nicholas came by one evening when everyone was asleep and tossed a bag of gold through a window to provide a dowry, and then another night, another bag for another daughter. Eventually, the father stopped him or caught him and wanted to thank him and announce it to everyone. St. Nicholas said, no, keep that a secret. All the credit only goes to God. It's from legends like that you have a St. Nicholas who cares about young people, who is generous, and you can see seeds for some later things. But this is a bishop. And then it's a long story about how the stories about him move into Western Europe, then how eventually they get to the United States, and it's in the United States we morph him into Santa Claus.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I think I was about 4 years old and I went to meet Santa, and some of the bad boys on my block told me Santa wasn't real and I shouldn't believe in Santa. So my test for, it was a litmus test at the time for Santa being real. I said, are you real, Santa? And this department store Santa said, of course I'm real. And I said, do you have elves? And when he said he had elves, he convinced me that he was real. Where do the elves come from, you know?
And in the morphing process, they came along the way, I think mainly through the influence of Thomas Nast. What's interesting about this, we often say a picture is worth a thousand words. Here is an illustrator who, not necessarily in writing, but in his pictures, added so much to Santa Claus lore. And so this Thomas Nast, who came up with the elephant and the donkey for the political parties and other things, is most known for his Santa Claus illustrations. And he gave us the North Pole. He gave us elves. He gave us writing letters to Santa and leaving out milk and cookies for Santa Claus to collect. These came not so much from an author, but from an illustrator.
Well, speaking about authors, you point out in your book that Dickens, and particularly A Christmas Carol, had a great deal to do with the kind of a revival of Christmas.
Yes, but prior to that, and this is, really goes back a century and a half before Dickens, in the mid-1600s, you had the Puritan Revolution in England. The Puritans tried to get rid of Christmas because they said the early Christians did not celebrate Christmas. They're right about that. And also, they just felt there was too much partying, so they tried to suppress Christmas.
And they also think it was kind of popish and a little bit too...
Yeah, it was a Catholic edition, and they didn't feel it was warranted by the Bible. And so even though they weren't fully successful, they really did discourage Christmas celebrations for more than a century in England. One of the most interesting pieces from or pieces of evidence from some historians were some people who read 45 years of the Times of London, the December issues, and in 20 of the 45 years, this is in the late 1700s, there was no mention of Christmas at all in the newspaper. So Christmas fell a long way, partly because of the Puritans, partly because of other things. But in the 1800s, it came roaring back, and one of the key figures was Charles Dickens, who was nostalgic about some of the old legends about Christmas. He wanted it to come back, and his story, A Christmas Carol, really doesn't so much reflect what Christmas was like in his time. In a way, he's helping recreate and relaunch Christmas, and he's very successful.
And Queen Victoria and Prince Albert played a role in this, too.
In the very same time period, and the reason there is Queen Victoria is from the House of Hanover, so there were people before her as well. The House of Hanover are people, royalty from German background. The Germans hadn't dealt with those Puritans a century and a half before, so they continued their Christmas celebrations pretty fully. And when Queen Victoria married Prince Albert, also German, they brought Christmas customs over, including the Christmas tree. Everyone wanted to do what Queen Victoria and Prince Albert did. I think the fascination with Victoria might be compared with some of the more recent fascination with Princess Di. And they furthered that Christmas snowball rolling along as well.
You've been listening to a special edition of Forum. Our guest in this segment was historian and professor of religious studies at Morningside College, Bruce David Forbes, author of Christmas, A Candid History. Stay with us.